Yes, Honest Actors is back with brand new episodes every Friday. To help me continue releasing new episodes without a sponsor, or to say thanks for your favourite old ones, click the support link in the episode description. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. It's a one-off, feeling generous, good deed for the day sort of thing. Think of it as bumping into me and buying me a drink. To find out more, click the support link. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
Yeah, mine's a large red.
I hate those guys.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Jamal Westman, and you're listening to the Honest Actors Podcast.
How you keeping?
Yeah, all right, man. Not too bad. Yeah, okay. You know, keeping steady with it all and taking each day as it comes, man. It's nuts. It's, you know, I mean, you know, to some degree, there's an element of a lot of us in our industry, I guess, being used to this kind of thing. But, you know, just kind of hanging on and waiting for the phone call or whatever it is, or, you know, trying to stay creative. But it's such a crazy time that the whole world stopped. You know, it's not just us, you know, and all.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of told myself that at the start. I said, we've been in training for this for years. Like, we're, my wife and I spend all day together in our house, unemployed most of the time. So it's right. We're totally used to this. Mm-hmm. And then something kicks in. You're like, it's different. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's that everybody else is in the same boat. But I don't know.
It's the threat of things, isn't it? It's the threat of, you know, loss of life, and that's not exactly what we're at home for in those, you know, in those kind of previous circumstances. We keep moving and see how it goes. The weather's been good, at least.
Yeah, I mean, not that we've been allowed to enjoy it unless we're in government, but, you know, what can you do?
Right.
Tell us, I always start with this question, and I always say it is one of my favorite questions in the whole thing. How did you become an actor? What was the story? How did you get into it?
Well, there's two different points of which I became an actor. There's one where I was, from anyone looking in, I was an actor. And then there was me realizing I was an actor. So there was like two different moments. The first bit was, I guess, started kind of school, secondary school. I always think that, I don't know, some people might say the first professional gig or the first amateur gig or whatever, but for me it always started definitely in terms of being on stage, learning lines. I'm going to go as far back as my nativity in year six. I had the most fun. I was in a choir, and I remember it was such a special day. I was in the choir, had a performance at the War Festival Hall with the Lambeth Little Big Voices, which is basically a collection of a choir service for young people from different schools in the borough. And I travelled from there, and I went to do my nativity play, and I had to perform. And my character was made up. We were doing Noah's Ark, and the character was made up. And but that element of like showbiz, like it's got to be done, we've got to do this thing, and you know, had to make up lines and kind of, as it were, chaperone or like host the show, the story of the nativity. So that was the first thing. And then I did the first kind of serious thing, I guess, where I was like, okay, this is a bit deeper than Noah's Ark's pretty deep. Was we did Stand By Me, and I was about 14, and we did Stand By Me, you know, the film with River Phoenix and such, and it was amazing. I did that and that was not just people in my own year group, that was people in sixth form all through the years, and I got to sit down, chill with them, have pizza, and feel like an equal. I wasn't treated as though I was like a kid, or I didn't belong. And so that was the first bug that I kind of caught from being in a rehearsal space, learning lines, playing a character and having the most fun. And that is the thing I've chased ever since. And it's always about the people that you share a space with and you explore with, and you're allowed to be vulnerable in front of and allowed to express yourself in front of. So that was the first kind of go for. And then we did like Macbeth and Pirates of the Curriculum, all kind of written by our English teacher, who was a bit of a, he was up for it. He was always up for it, up for putting on a play. So I have to thank him big time for that.
That's 6 year old, right? And you're in a choir. So are you kind of behind the action, or I take it there are people performing specific roles within that, or how did that work?
Well, the choir, it was like a Lambeth Youth Service. So we all had a shared responsibility, and for different kind of performances, some people would be selected for solos and stuff like that.
I don't know
if I ever did any.
But it just grabbed you, like just at that 6 year old was in that thing. Was it like doing a sport? Was it just feeling like, oh, I like this? If somebody says to me, will you do this again? It's like, if somebody says, do you want a game of football? I'll be right up for it. Was there something different about it? Did you know it was something like, did it feel different when you spoke about it with your family? Did they kind of take it seriously? Did you talk about wanting to do more of it?
I don't think there was ever an element of me kind of thinking this is, I never thought of it as a job or a thing like that I could do as a career, or I just enjoyed it. And I think that was something that my mum instilled with me. It's just like, enjoy what you're doing. Enjoy being young, enjoy having fun. And that part of me included singing. And I was playing football as well. So that was, yeah. And that was, you said six. That was year six. So I would have been about 11.
Oh, right.
But like easily from 6 years old as well. I mean, I love to sing. There's like, you know, videotapes of my mum recording me and stuff like that. I just enjoyed, singing. Love that.
And do you think that was different to other year sixes? Like, you know, in your family, looking back, are you the kid that wanted to be in the limelight? Like if it was 2020 and you were on a family Zoom, would you be the kid pushed to the front to sing for everyone else to cheer them up? Or is it like, you know, did you have a party piece? Were you chomping at the bit to kind of, did you dress up? What kind of, how did that manifest itself at all day to day or week to week?
I think I just had a confidence, I guess, is the best way to describe it. I had a certain type of confidence and willingness to, I don't know if it was like necessarily a need for the limelight or anything like that. I was just up for it. I was up like for performance. I think that started from football, having a confidence in that respect. And a lot of kids that kind of look to, like, you know, other kids that could kick ball was, you know, something special. And so I think that kind of element played into my relationship to my peers in the classroom, and then also just my notion of performance in terms of being in choirs, joining a solo choir. And this is all in like primary school. And just kind of, I was tall. I was super I was the tallest kid. So like a lot of things played towards, you know,
you got attention whether you wanted it or not,
right,
kind of thing.
Right. It kind of, people would kind of look to me just regardless, because I'm just tall. You can't miss me. And also, particularly like primary school, I turned up in the middle of the year as well. So like there was just that middle of school years. I was like in like year three, I turned up because I'd been to a school before. And so there's just that element of, being slightly outside, definitely. And that kind of played on a lot of different kind of tones, as in it wasn't just being tall or just being a kid that came from another school. It's also being mixed race, that kind of element, which I wasn't probably too aware of as in primary school, but certainly I was much more aware of in secondary. And that notion of playing in between the lines, or like trying to find my identity with, you know, because at the end of the day in secondary school, those realities that are happening outside of the school are happening inside the school. The consequences of that we're not really sure of, but they still play a role. So for instance, I remember playing, there was a thing, it was like just fun for us, but at the time you didn't really know what the consequences are, what really meant. But there was even a time where, and this is like, you know, 2004 or 2005, there was the black kids versus the white kids in football, and it's nuts, it's crazy. But we all did it.
Was it a totally innocent, like shirts and skins? Like it's just an easy.
Yeah, absolutely. It was just kind of gone. And let's just do the black kids versus the white kids. Not knowing the full ramifications, the historical context of which we're doing it. We just know this is a thing that we could do. And so, you know, I was like, I don't know who I'm playing for right now. Referee? And
did you enjoy that kind of... I mean, in school, that kind of, you say you arrived in year three, that being on the fringe in some ways, was that a role you enjoyed, or did you try to kind of get back into the group by other means?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely wanted to be a part of a collective. I wanted to have, you know, I did. I found my tribes, you know, in each different kind of scenario. There was no doubts there. But I also, I think, certainly enjoyed... on another side of it, yeah, kind of being with different groups of people and hanging out with them. There was no kind of thing where it's like, I can't hang out with those people because I can't hang out with these people. And that comes from, yeah, just being exposed to different things. For instance, like one side of my cousins listened to rap, hip hop, and another side listened to heavy metal. So I just had that thing where I didn't kind of say this, I can't be with, you know, I didn't, become dogmatic in my associations.
Was there anybody in kind of your family group that was in performance or that encouraged you particularly, or was it something very much that happened at school outside of that kind of family group?
So my mum, she plays piano. She played piano to a pretty high grade, and then she sings as well, and not necessarily on a performative level or, you know, getting paid to do it, but she definitely has a passion for music. And so definitely kind of encouraged me down that line. I can have really strong recollections of her trying to get me to play the piano at five, and I just couldn't do it. I couldn't sit there, man. But there was always that encouragement for sure. Encouraged me to join choirs and stuff.
And do you think, like, at 14 you did,
Stand By Me.
Stand By Me.
Yeah.
And did that kind of wake something up, the possibility that this might be something that you could pursue more seriously? Or was it still
no.
Just, I really like this, the same way as I really like football, the same way as I really like watching movies or whatever it is. It's just another thing I like to do.
Definitely.
When did it become something that you might get, that you might pursue, that you admitted to yourself?
This is the thing.
You know, other kids want to be firemen, other kids want to be, you know, whatever, and you wanted to maybe be an actor.
I'd say about 3 years later, so I was about, yes, you know, well, yeah, 16, 17, 18, in and around that, when I went to sixth form. So I did drama and theatre studies for A-level. And that was, I wanted to do that. But obviously when you go to A-levels, things get a bit more serious and a bit more like, okay, you know, we're whittling it down to what you think you want to pursue. So that certainly went in there. And that's when I heard about drama school. And I heard about kind of the next steps that one could take on the path of acting, which I wasn't aware of. I had no idea how you get into any of that. I didn't have a clue, really. I had, you know, I was in youth groups and stuff like that, but yeah.
In that naivety, or that kind of the first stages of finding out what is the reality, or what is the reality being presented to you of what might confront you in your career and over the next decades or whatever it is you choose to do. What, looking back now and knowing what you know about the industry, and I'm pretty sure you know a hell of a lot more now than you did then.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
What do you think? What did you expect of it then? Whenever you maybe were explained this is how it works, and there's drama schools, and then you go out and you work. Like, how did you expect it would play out?
I didn't really know. I think for me, it was, again, actually in a similar fashion to how I was in secondary school and even in the primary school years. It was just kind of keeping yourself involved with different groups. So it was, you know, go find a youth theatre, find an amateur theatre. And my mum was definitely a part of, like, okay, well, you just need to be in those circles and, you know, connecting effectively. You call it networking, but for me, it was more a matter of just being a part of different groups and exploring the profession in that, you know, through whatever doors were open. And through those conversations, you just learn that little bit more. So, you know, I went to WAC, Weekend Arts College, up in Belsize Park, met Che Walker actually, and did a couple nights with Che Walker. He did a lot of charity nights, and that he'd get me on stage and I'd do some performances alongside Sheila Team and some others. And so you're kind of like, okay, and then some people might be making progress in their respective paths. And then you're like, okay, that's a path that is available to people if that's possible. Thinking about getting an agent, writing to agents, being on stage, and then getting agents to come see you on stage in whatever you're in. And actually, one of the great breaks was gone.
So go ahead. No, you're about to say something.
Oh no, just one of the great breaks was I was in a youth theatre at Oval House with a guy called Toby Clark, and those are people I still call friends to this day. And Bolag Bhaji, she was obviously doing really well in her writing and on her path, and she was commissioned to write a piece for us, and which she did. It's called Take a Deep Breath and Breathe, and we performed it at Oval House, and then it managed to get picked up and it transferred over to Bussey Building, and we did a performance there. So like, that was amazing. You know, we had no expectation of something like that to happen, you know, would happen at all. And so it's like things like that, just little moments.
Yeah.
And it's always down to the youth theatres and youth groups for sure.
So first time you got paid to act, what age were you?
I think I might even got paid for that, for Take a Deep Breath. I think it might have been like 50 quid or something like that. For basically the profits that we made, and we didn't, you know, make money profits at all, but we broke just above the parapet, and got 50 quid off that, and was like, oh damn, this is a thing, you know, you can get paid off this. It was a
good feeling. Do you remember what you spent it on, or is that asking too much?
I think I went straight into my account. I just left it there. I didn't do anything to it. Is that too much?
I
was still there, just waiting to be used.
Ring fenced. You're going to use it for the right thing. It has to be spent in the right thing. So like, you talked about, you know, you mentioned kind of in passing there, you know, things, various things you were doing, writing to agents. Like, do you get turned down? Like, jam get turned down for stuff? How does that feel? Like, does that sit in with what you're expecting at that point? Do you expect that, you know, you're going to have a career regardless? It's going to be, you know, it might be slightly difficult, but you'll get there eventually. How do those knockbacks feel to a young guy setting out on that path?
More often than not, I got no replies. Any reply that I did get actually felt kind of good. I was like, oh, they at least acknowledged me.
Yeah, they got it. Yeah,
at least totally. They got it. Do you know what I mean? At least they had the decency to reply back. And you kind of think in that very...
No thanks. Well, that's nice.
Well, they, you know, they put a thanks on there as well as a no, so it's very clear. and for me, I think in my kind of... for sure, there was always that thing. I have an intention. This is my intention. It's going to happen. I'm going to, you know, progress as it were and work. And I'm going to make a life out of this craft. And so if you can be a part of that, if you, you know, want to come see the show, great, great. If not, then that's fine. But if they reply, then I'm like, oh, okay, well, I've got their attention at least. So, you know, it's one of those things where you always put in the email, if not this one, maybe another time. And so they've gone, no, thank you, but please do keep in touch. Sometimes they say, oh, no, thanks, we kind of feel at this moment. And you're like, okay, cool.
Looking back on that, do you think there's anything you did wrong? Do you think you were either too backward or too arrogant or too, do you think you maybe, you know, had too much to learn? Like what do you put it down to? Is it just that those people didn't see what you had, or were you lacking anything at that point that you now have?
I didn't have a showreel. I didn't have anything like that. I didn't have any content that I definitely could have done. And I think that's just something I'd definitely tell to any person of that age when I was that age, is like, if you got a phone, there's loads of free content online, scripts, films that you like, you know, keep trawling through Mubi or whatever it is. And yeah, just come up with a scene with a friend on your phone, record it, and then put it all together and call it a showreel. And also, like, you can really play on those things. You can play on camera angles and be your own creative kind of genius. You don't need...
And you might find that there's something you like doing that isn't acting as well. You can find you got a skill for it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It might be editing. I mean, I just kind of stumbled on that in terms of, like, Breathless and jump shots. I'm like, oh, this is... Jump cuts. I'm like, oh, this is a whole new thing that really makes a film. So, other than that, I think I could have been better with my words. You know, just... but that's, like, just... It's almost like digging at a hole that doesn't get any deeper. You're kind of like, I was never going to get a yes, no matter what I did with my words. But I certainly think, looking back on maybe some emails I sent, I could have maybe phrased them a little bit better. Sometimes I actually remember after I'd been to drama school, I was emailing one agent. I think I just pissed her off. I just emailed too many times. But I was just like, I'd kind of left drama school without an agent. So I was like, man, this is... It wasn't what I'd expected. And most people don't, right? You think you go to drama school and...
And you went to a good drama school, man.
Went to a great drama school. You know, all the best training I could have asked for, more kind of contact hours than you get training to be a doctor. So, you know, it was...
And what, I mean, fuck, it's, as you say, it's a great expression, digging at a hole that doesn't get deeper. How does that happen? Like, for somebody listening, you're going, right, well, we know where this story has arrived at by this point in your life. How does that guy come out of, with the skills and talents that you have, how does that guy come out of RADA, one of the greatest launch pads in the industry, and not get an agent? Like, that, there'll be a lot of people who haven't yet gone to drama school who'll be like, what the fuck? What's what hope have we got? And then on the other side of it who will have come out of drama school, got an agent, like, been signed in fucking first year, basically.
Right.
And then not have worked.
Right.
Like, it's that great thing about our industry. There's no rhyme nor reason to it, apparently. Like, what are you looking back? What do you put that down to?
I put that down, well... There is, to some degree, well, first of all, I could put it down to maybe the parts that I got. You know, people, and I do honor that notion of there's no small parts, only small actors, very true. And that is certainly the way that an actor has to approach things. But for an agent...
But you were very tall, so there's no small parts, only very tall actors.
You're on the money there. Didn't matter if I was just like, you know, the torchbearer, you couldn't miss me. There's no way that guy's a small actor. But then it's like, even in that respect, right? I think, I don't know, it's always that battle, actually, that I'm still to some degree contending with, about what roles people expect you in and what roles people want to see you in. And I certainly felt that in that third year of like, okay, there's certain roles that I think play to my strengths in terms of looking like a leading man, however you want to kind of cut that. But then it's like, why should I have to submit to that kind of box? Like, which we, on many different levels, people have to submit themselves to, based on race, based on gender, all sorts. And that's the frustration there. And I think that plays plays a big role in third year for sure. But I didn't necessarily get all the, particularly in that first half, I don't know how they do it. They say your agents turn up usually for the first few shows and then it kind of dwindles towards the end. And there's all those kind of things that basically make you kind of paranoid and lose your mind. But then I wasn't the only one that didn't end up with an agent. And then some people did end up with an agent. And as you say, haven't been working. I think that was hard for a lot of people in our year as well. And is, you know, can be for anyone that kind of comes out of drama school thinking that they've done the thing, is that you leave and you're not working. And you're like, but I just went to wherever it is, RADA, Lambda.
And the thing about drama school, I imagine, not having been, it's, you know, surmising, but you work solidly for 3 years. It feels like you've worked solidly.
Yeah.
So actually the one thing drama still doesn't prepare you for is being without a purpose, is being unemployed.
Oh man, for sure. For the sake of them trying to cram, like, you know, effectively 10 years of what will percolate over 10 years anyway, of work and study. And then, yeah, in that time, yeah, absolutely. That kind of indirectly, they don't prepare you for that. I'm sure they told us that. I'm sure they said, hey, you might not be working, but they didn't tell us what it would feel like at all. And that was, yeah, it was hard for a lot of people, you know. That's, you know, as for any person who hasn't got work or has high expectations of themselves, it can lead to, like, you know, depression and all sorts.
Did you, I mean, we'll get around to this at the end. At any point did you start to lose faith in your ability to do it?
No.
I mean, do it separately to make it, whatever that means, but make a living. Did you ever lose confidence in your ability to, that you, maybe I'm just not that good?
Maybe before drama school, maybe before. I mean, I was training to become a football coach, so I guess there was that element of, hey, I need a safety net and this might not work out. But I think I didn't really play too much thoughts on my abilities in that respect. I just loved doing it, and it was more like, hey, this might not pay, so I guess I have to find something that definitely can support me in that respect. But I had this, you know, certainly in those years, I still had the support, and I always have had the support of my mum, and, you know, like a home and a place to go back to, which wasn't the case for people in my year and other years, and plenty of people in the industry and around the world in other avenues of life. So there was always that kind of protection there and that safety net. I never doubted myself in that respect, though. I was kind of like, I just love doing this, and I'm willing to.
So I'm going to leave behind the kind of looking that far back. But before I do, I like to work under the assumption, and this may sound odd, given the demographic of people who listen to this, but that nobody knows who anybody that's being interviewed is. Mm. And so rather than them just go, that's that guy or that woman from whatever, I like to say, if you could define yourself by a single project, so people would go, oh, that's Jamil, he did X. Like, what's the thing you're most proud of? What's the thing you most like to be associated with that you've done from year six on? What's the thing that you think?
the work that
I did on that nativity play. I wish people would just forget everything else, because that was the real me, right? What is the thing that you're most proud of? Or one of the things. I hate putting people in the people
things.
Who work with you in other jobs go, oh, hold on. what about the magic that we had? So what's one of the things that might be at the top of that list?
Whilst not putting anyone out or any experience I had or shared with anyone along the way. It'd be amiss for me to say that Hamilton wasn't something that I'm deeply proud to be a part of and cherish and will cherish for the rest of my life. There's no doubts there.
Thought you might say that.
Yeah, I mean, who can deny the truth? It's such an amazing piece of work. And also, I think one thing that a lot of people aren't afforded in our industry is a chance to constantly explore a role consistently for, well, it's going to be 3 years for me, but 2 years at the moment. And to find, and so referring back to that phrase of like digging a hole doesn't get deeper, it just gets deeper. It keeps getting deeper every time. And it could be a little stone that you move, a little pebble, but that pebble just feels like so profound in what realizations and nuances you can just discover in character and story. So yeah, 100%. But then again, you're kind of made up of all the experiences you've had prior to that. Hamilton wouldn't have been such a joy were it not for the things that I've done prior to that. So it stands beside or on the shoulders of all the things I've done ever since I kind of decided to take the piss in a classroom.
That's a beautiful answer, man. But you would, I mean, it would have been, if you'd said anything except Hamilton, I'd have been like, what? Do you want to work again? All right. Sure. So getting into kind of the more kind of present day, not so much, I guess, if you've been doing the same job for a couple of years, but generally speaking, do you enjoy the process by which work comes? Do you enjoy auditioning?
No, not really.
You're not one of those actors, and a lot of people are, that says, oh, do you know what? It's just an opportunity to act and I love it. And I go into a room and I meet some new people and it's great.
Absolutely. I'm with that. It's very true.
But
there's always going to be a but there. Because like, I would, I don't know what kind of world. I just kind of, yeah, when it's like, hey, yeah, I'll do this. And I love meeting you guys. And maybe we'll see each other on this long, winding yellow brick road. There's an element for me that just feels like the reality is uncertainty is not fun. Uncertainty of when you're going to get the next job, how you're going to, you know, live day to day is not fun. And also just like projects that are amazing that you'd love to be a part of that, you know, you nights before are just staying up, giving it, which is an amazing thing to be able to do for something that you're passionate about. But then, you know, to say, you know, get a no or to be unsure and then to live in limbo. I mean, I have anxiety as it is. So kind of sitting going, I don't know if I could, have done better, or, you know, constantly obsessing over something, which you can, or some people can let go and say, once it's done and there's nothing to do about it. But and maybe it's the nature of doing the show and always thinking about doing Hamilton and thinking about the show before and how that can be kind of made better, or what else can kind of be introduced, or
That's a positive force if you have another opportunity to put right things.
Absolutely.
I always said that about theatre. The lovely thing was, if you fuck it up, you've always got tomorrow, unless it's your last show, and then you've got to live with it for the rest of your life. But like, you know, exactly. Film, I always think the problem is that if you fuck it up, that's it for eternity, you know?
Right.
And that's hard to live with. So I guess anxiety is better suited in theatre, but you know, above all that, you've got to say somebody with anxiety isn't best suited to being an actor. Like, it's not a lifestyle that lends itself to stability or security or surety of any kind.
No, which, if anything, I think puts you on the pulse of reality more than anything else. You know, this kind of idea that it's just one straight line is a myth. It doesn't really exist. Or, you know, even the way that we look at the political spectrum and discourse, or how the stocks are working, it's kind of like, oh, no, we're just, you know, things aren't going to, it's like, nah, up and down, man, up and down. You never know what the next moment's going to be. And that's just closer to reality. You don't want to kind of, you know, in terms of pain and joy, it makes, I kind of live by that philosophy of like, you know, there is no joy without pain and there's no pain without joy. They kind of come hand in hand, and each allow the other to be fully experienced as we should experience life. I mean, for sure, if it's great script, I'm up for it. If it's like the night before, sometimes it's just down to the timing. It's kind of like, you've got to be in tomorrow, you've got self-tape this tomorrow, and it's like, yeah, okay, cool, let's do it. But it's, I'd love to sit with this a bit more, you know, and theatre is a bit more open to those kind of conversations and time.
I'd love to sit with those 11 pages, not print them or look at them for 3 days before I start panicking. Like, that's usually my thing. It's like, you know, just let me have 3 days to do nothing. Let me have 3 days to just do anything but your script. Like, when I'm really honest about it, when I complain, it's not because I'm actually going to fucking start work on it, to be truthful, most of the time. It's mostly because I want to just know it's there in the inbox.
Right. I want to know it's there. Yeah. I want to have kind of autonomy. I want to have agency.
Yeah, totally. I'll decide. Yeah.
And that, to be fair, that has always rung true for me in terms of auditioning for drama school. There was that feeling of, it's not about I need this or I'm nothing without this. It's kind of like, I'm already doing the thing. And, you know, it'd be great to be here. I'd love to be here, but I'm already on this thing that I'm doing. So I think it's about establishing that. And it's different for different people. I guess as you get further along and you've got a backlog or, you know, catalog of things that you've done, and you're like, yeah, I'm kind of here. I've arrived. And maybe I'm talking to myself right now, just recognize you've arrived. That when those self-tapes come in, whatever it is, it's kind of like, oh yeah, cool, I'm already on this thing. Rather than it becoming like, oh my God, this is the be all and end all, I need to.
And you've always felt like that. Like, I know I was on Instagram last night and I just caught, you were doing a live and I caught a bit about you talking about like 3 or 4 times your audition for drama school.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit. Like that in itself is kind of is interesting, because you're both contented that you're on this thing, but you're going to go back and go, listen, I'm going to ask again. I'm going to knock the door again. And if you don't want it, then that's fine. And then the following year you go back. And I think that in itself is an interesting thing about you, perhaps, that that you do have that confidence in where you're at, but you're also pushing forward.
Yeah, 100%. It's kind of like keep all avenues open. And fortunately, I was working at Sainsbury's, so I could afford the audition fees. It's just like, yo, I could, you know, some people is like, and understandably, it's like, that's astronomical. That's like hundreds and hundreds of pounds every single year that I just don't have. Fortunately, I was living at home. Mum wasn't putting too much pressure on me at that time in terms of rent or like paying towards the house. And so it was kind of, okay, I've got this Sainsbury's money. I can use it. And instead of like, you know, going out and doing all these other things, which I certainly was doing, but maybe lessened whilst I was in audition season. I thought, well, why not? And I know for a fact I will get kind of a condensed and rigorous form of training that I could definitely do with.
Do you know when an audition's gone well? Like, let's take the RADA example, just because it's what we're on now. You audition four times or three times.
Right.
That last time, the one that you would ultimately get in, did you know you'd nailed it? Or did you think you'd nail the other ones? Or did you think they were all terrible? Like, what's your usual kind of mental state post-audition?
I knew I'd had a good go at it because the piece had spoken to me like no other piece before it that I'd done. Or at least there was a couple of pieces that I'd done. But I found a way, like there was almost an opening and a feeling of, I'd seen, basically prior to that, I'd seen a play called God's Property by Arinze Kene. And that play just spoke to my soul, spoke to my identity, spoke to my life as it had been thus far. It was just such a beautiful piece. First time I'd ever kind of cried or felt such an overwhelming form of emotion to a piece. And so I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do. This is it. I just understood. I felt perhaps that sacred thing, that sacred relationship to theatre and to performance as an audience member, which I don't think I'd had before. And so I just realised what that relationship was. I knew what it was like on stage. I knew that thing, but I just didn't know that relationship to the audience in the same way until I became that audience member that was affected by it. And I think that did a lot for me, just in terms of how I approached the piece and how I approached, you know, my classical pieces as well.
So you selected that, right? So then let's take it to something like you get that script in your inbox and you're like going down through Soho to go to some back room or somewhere to go and read on tape or, you know, meet someone, whatever.
Yeah.
You come out of that. Do you know when it's gone well?
That's if they've given me the whole fucking script. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes they give you a little bit of nothing and you're like, I have no idea.
What do you want me to do with this?
Don't know. And so I had to kind of let go and just go, well, I could have done a great job, but I'm just not the person they're looking for. And I'm quite fine with that. That's okay. I've had feelings where I feel like I've done a good job.
Do you get feedback? Is there any kind of feedback you get that annoys you? if you get it? Is there a kind of a standard, oh, not that again feedback that you get?
Oh, no. Oh, unfortunately, I'm sure I'll get that at some point. No, I haven't had that moment. Well, there's only one thing that I've had that I recall. It was one of those things where I was like, one of the associate casting directors was like, you did a great job, man. You did a really, really, really great job. Didn't get the job. You know, like, it was like...
Even on a good day, I'm not good
Even
enough.
On a good day.
Even on a good day.
He was, like, the way he was like, man, yeah, they liked that. They loved that. They really loved it. Like, great. I mean, at that moment, I was like, oh, what a good feeling. And to be fair, thank you for that feeling that I managed to walk away with for a few hours until, you know, later down the line, a few days later, it was like, yeah, I'm not taking it.
Yeah, but then those in between those days, there's the day of, like, I wonder if they haven't contacted me yet. Probably have to... run up by the execs and then like two days pass, you know, the usual kind of like gradually it's 4 weeks later and you're like, I must phone my agent. I haven't heard, that's strange because I'm pretty sure I got it. Like, you know,
absolutely.
Mustn't be happening. Mustn't be happening.
Probably cancelling the whole thing.
And
so those scenes are a bit mad, but
Do you have, or did you have, do you have people who you consider to be rivals? Not necessarily in the sense, traditional sense of like, you know, like a boxer might, but like, people who you think you see in an audition room and you think, oh, for fuck's sake, not that guy.
Nah, not at all. I think there's people that I kind of, coming from, and actually now seeing the kind of toxicity of like competition and thinking and comparing yourself to someone else. By the moment you can kind of compare yourself, as other people will do, right? You'll get other people say, this person's like this person, so on and so forth. The moment you do that to yourself, it's like the death of your kind of potential. It's the death of your like unique qualities and things that you haven't even discovered in yourself. I always return to this kind of hypothetical kind of theorem, which is Jahari's window. Known knowns, known unknowns, and like in terms of what people know about you, you don't know about yourself, things you don't know that other people don't know. And it's just like that one, the unknown unknowns, endless possibilities. So don't shortchange yourself by comparing yourself to someone else. Only notion of me going, there's someone that would probably get a similar casting to me, which is an undeniable truth of the gig, is I'd look at people and say, hey, they're doing some cool things. I would definitely like to do those things.
How important do you think it is luck then in that equation, in the journey from walking in the room, uttering the words, leaving, to getting the phone call to say they've just called, they'd like to offer it to you? Great words. They'd like to offer you the part is one of the greatest phrases you can hear on the other end of the phone.
Lord of mercy.
Like, how important do you think is luck in the kind of equation of talent, luck, you know, whatever else is in there?
I think there's almost like, they work hand in hand, right? You could have had not a very...
Which is the bigger hand?
Damn, that's, I would say the bigger hand and the most important hand to anyone is what you do. And then the rest is up to whoever. That's the thing that I certainly feel when it comes to entering an audition or a meeting or whatever. I call them meetings. I don't call them auditions. Auditions makes me feel like the power's in the hands of other people.
Yeah, and I love that move towards calling them meetings, because I think it was a thing we all kind of did collectively.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a few actor mates who wouldn't allow it. Like, they just wouldn't have it if I said I've got a meeting. They'd go audition. And I'd be like, because a meeting makes it sound like it's an equal transaction. Like, you know, you meet someone for coffee. You meet a friend for coffee, right? Exactly, right? So that's what I love about it is you go, well, tell me why you call it a meeting then, in those terms, like equal transaction.
It's a meeting because I have something to offer that I believe will make whatever you're doing the good thing that it will be. Like, there's a reality. It's like, I don't know, parallel universes. It's almost like if we do go down this road, it will be the best road that you've taken. If you don't go down this road, then it's the best road you've taken is just without me. That's fine. I think it's just about giving yourself that kind of permission to say, I have something to offer, but you have something to offer me. We're both having this.
Whereas an audition conjures you on stage in a darkened auditorium where a voice at the background just screams,
stand behind that line,
I don't believe you.
Don't look at them
next.
In the eyes.
Yeah. Oh. All that shit.
Literally.
Meeting.
And all that shit that comes with it.
Meeting it is.
I mean, there's another level of conversation about how actors are treated within the industry, but also how actors are treated on a political scale in terms of, oh, you're just an actor, stick to your kind of job. And then just how people are treated and how much we're empowered to step into any space. And then there's other elements where you bring in race or class and all those other things. So 100% it's a meeting. I am who I am and you are who you are. There's no less than or more than.
An agent once told me, following that journey from unemployment to employment and then beyond, an agent once told me that the only time an actor is truly happy is when they get the call to say they've got the job. Those words, you know, they want to offer you the part. And then the self-doubt kicks in, was what he said to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly at times have recognized that in myself, that sometimes I think I'm anxious about an audition, but the fear only really kicks in when I get the job. Have you ever felt that about anything?
Only for one job. I didn't really, surprisingly, didn't feel that too tough for Hamilton. I guess the fear kind of maybe kicked in terms of the level of performance, in terms of my voice and getting that into a good place to do it over and over again. But by that time I was like, oh man, this is a lot. I was already in it. So it was kind of cool. The job that I was like, okay, I have to really get myself into this is I did The White Devil at the Globe. And for me, being classical text, being at the Globe, and being with a script that and a piece that I wasn't really too familiar with, that kind of, I'm not sure how I'm going to fare in this. And also, like, I was meant to be trained in this. Like, there's the element, you know, this is your bread and butter. This is meant to be your bread and butter. This is, you know, there's a line of actors that have done this and have been a part of this history, which is so embedded in our culture. So, you know, you've got to be worth your salt. So, yeah, definitely had fear there. And also, I was understudying. And, like, I only realized that actually on the day that I turned up, they were like, yeah, so you're understudying, like, all the guys. I was like, what? Well, I was like, I thought it was only these two guys. So there was that element. I think that's, hey, that's part of the trade. Big ask, but part of the trade, really, when they kind of say you're loaded with this, this, and this, and you're kind of like, okay, cool. But yeah, I think it was the text and being like, okay, I really want to.
And have you ever got nervous going on stage or suffered from stage fright or anything that you know, approximates that kind of stage fright?
For sure, I'd certainly get nervous before going on stage, but I always try and channel it into the
Do you get nervous still with Hamilton? I mean, you must have done that show like 700 times more.
I do, yes, I do. I do because, you know, it's the first time for some people seeing it. And also, I just feel like you want to just give it your best. And to give it your best, you have to care. And to care means you're going to get nervous. So I don't know if that sounds like some kind of sociopathic way to
get to
it.
Yeah, no, but I think. It would, it's like, maybe it's because I don't care, but I don't get nervous going on stage, but then I've never done something the scale of that part in a show like that. So I guess I probably would shit myself every single time. I don't know, like, it's really hard for me to answer, but I also understand why doing it 700 times wouldn't necessarily lessen that feeling of like, this is huge.
It was no way as fearful as as nervous as the first times I did it, for sure, or when I came back after like a month off. But I think it's
you come back after a month off and you're like, I can't remember this shit, where am I standing,
what's his name,
who am I playing? Yeah.
And but then I think that nervousness also comes into saying his name, saying that name, saying who you are. My name is this. My name is Alexander Hamilton. And kind of saying, like, you always want to be as truthful as possible. So it's like, you know, being honest with the day. How's the day been? Okay. And allowing that truth to exist and to take you, you know, once you're on, you're on. Once you're on that locomotive train, you're riding and you don't want to get ridden by the train. You want to ride that train. So, yeah, I think there's always that feeling of being on it, being sharp. And so I do get kind of like, I need, you know, I want to be there. And so, you know, that's all the preparation that goes in before. And being connected with the company that you're with as well.
Enter coronavirus, right?
Enter coronavirus.
So if you go off stage for a month and going back, it's like, oh, Jesus Christ almighty. Like, what do you feel now? Like, we're in a situation now where we just don't know when we're all going back to work,
right,
in this industry. Mm. When the theatres will be open, how that'll look, what it'll be like, whether you'll be playing the 20% house, 50% house, full house. We know it'll be fucking joyous when it happens,
right,
and that, you know, you'll get a standing ovation no matter what the fuck you do that first night. And that's good news, right?
Yeah, I'll scat the whole thing.
But have you been like, do you run lines sometimes? Like, what are you just like, is it parked? Have you parked it completely? Like, how are you managing that feeling of going from being in this show that's running and being successful and still, you know, top of its game, to sitting idly? I suppose it's like leaving drama school and going into unemployment. Like, how does it feel?
I would say I've parked it. I parked it in so much as I've got family members that listen to it. So, I mean, I've parked it for myself, but I'm happy to, I love listening to it. I mean, I love the music, but I've parked it. In terms of when we're coming back, we've been told we're not coming back until there's a full house. Until we can establish that, so until it's the safest space to enter, which is, you know, way down the line, probably 2021. But then again, in the same instance, I'm still returning to it. I've still got connections with people in the company, and we're still just talking about how we're all getting on. And then I'm also writing a piece that is kind of recontextualizing a cabinet battle. So if people know it, there's a cabinet battle, and I'm like, hey, I'm gonna just recontextualize this about stay at home or go out. I mean, so I'm obsessed. I can't leave the show. And also, I've been going through
it's in the fiber of your body. I think if you repeat words, you know, it's like one of those things about, like, you know, manifest destiny or whatever. Like, you repeat certain things to yourself every day, they become part of who you are. And I guess that character has become, anybody who's played a character for a long period of time, whether you like it or not, something about that becomes embedded in your fucking genes.
Oh man, for sure. And also, like, with the way that Hamilton was in his time, in terms of, you know, the non-stop writing of ratifying the constitution and just the endless communications and political discourse. I feel like, hey, I can never reach that height, but I'm like, I need to kind of be in that mindset of like, let's go, because the times are just as crucial, the stakes are just as high. And we all have a contribution to make, or I certainly feel like there's a contribution I can make, and there's other people around me who I think voices need to be heard. So that was certainly instilled by Hamilton. Hamilton's opened up loads of other kind of intrigues, I guess, in terms of even looking at the Native American history. So when you say manifest destiny, for that, for me, that speaks of how the settler colonists kind of viewed themselves as like, this is our, we're meant to be here, this is our destiny to be on this land. And it's kind of like that mentality is the reason for a genocide of millions and millions of Native Americans. So yeah, and also, but you know, there's so many words in the show that if you say like one little phrase, I'm like, oh, that reminds me of the letter that Angelica wrote back to Hamilton. So it's endless. Yeah, I'm now in the world.
It's like when you're in a play, no matter what the play is, you just have to constantly quote the play at other people in the play. Does it, that's, right? That's the game.
that is what everyone does.
That's the game, right?
That's what everyone does in every show that I've ever been in. It's always quoting it until we can't remember the lines anymore because we are in that world.
What's the longest you've ever gone without work?
The longest I've gone with, right, so is it gone without work with no knowledge of if I'm going to work, or gone without work knowing that work's long on the horizon? Probably the work when there's no work, right? No work at all.
Yeah, I guess.
Nada. Actually, when I left drama school, when I left drama school.
How long's that?
So drama school... I've been really lucky. I left drama school, obviously I had no agent and no real in my head prospect of getting on a stage anytime soon, and I started rehearsals for the Royal Court in September, so that was like end of May till September, so like what's that, May, June, July, August, September, 4 months,
I'm not gonna say lucky, but you've been busy is one way of kind of
busy. Definitely. I say luck just in the sense of one of my friends who had an agent and was at drama school had auditioned for this piece, or had a meeting for this piece. It was auditioning back then. Meeting only came in maybe like 2017. he was like, hey, I've done this piece, and this is the play that they're putting on. I think you'd be really cool for it. And it was right up my street. It was based set in South London. It's called Torn, Nathaniel Martello White. And it was, and I knew that world. I'd, I've been there, and it spoke very close to home. So he just said, hey, and that's not always the case, right? And that turns back to that notion of competition or comparison.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah, we just
quote the government, we're in this together, man.
Hey. They couldn't have said it better. You know, I hold on to my man no matter what happens. Okay, that's my boy. And he's probably the second prime minister just behind the wings. He's like a terrible version of Hamilton behind Washington. So he offered that for me, and he just didn't see that. You know, he didn't see that competition. That's just so important. And we managed to have that in the year. There's always a danger, right? This kind of scarcity complex that even enters in the third year of the RADA or any kind of drama school is like, hey, we're all trying to get the same agent and we're all so damn different. And we just have to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
We're different.
Yeah.
Different qualities, different whatever it is, which is unique and different.
So this RADA friend, then I'm taking that path wasn't as smooth for them.
For them, his name's Luke Brady. I mean, he's known. He's great. He was the Prince of Egypt. He was just recently played Prince of Egypt. He's done plenty of work before even going to RADA. Amazing, loveliest guy. And just the most honest and humble and beautiful people. And he, he's been doing a thing. I mean, actually, he's, you know, it's, as for loads of people now, yeah, right? He's just kind of, we're all waiting, man. We're waiting for the phone to ring, or just try, you know, trying to get on that gig or that job. But he's just so kind of endless in his possibilities and potential that he's good. But he did Prince of Egypt playing Moses. But then, like, the, you know, that rocky ride of that closed down because of COVID. But fortunately, I think with DreamWorks and stuff, I think they're being held on.
Okay, so just not, we're kind of nearly through it, so it's kind of a bit of a tone shift. Do you think acting's difficult?
Is it difficult? Doesn't have to be, but it frequently is. Yeah.
Do you think, like, I used to have a discussion with a friend, and I've changed my opinion on this. This is like going back 15 years. And I used to always say what we do, like, I'm always in awe of musicians, because I always think, like, if somebody sits down, take your mom, sits at the piano, mm-hmm. at a level where they're not professional and they're not getting paid, I'm always just fucking blown away by it. Because it's something I can't do, so I can see the difficulty level in it. Mm-hmm. And I guess because hopefully I can do it, you can do it, we don't see the difficulty level in it. Maybe other people do and we don't. But I'm kind of interested in that sense of, like, music's easier to quantify how difficult. There's grades. Like, there's no grade 8 acting. Oh, how good an actor is? Well, he's done grade 8. Like, oh, right. Fuck, he's a grade 8. Right, he got his grade 8 when he was 13. Fucking hell. Like, you know, there's no measurable kind of, you know, schemata or whatever the word is for quantifying what it is we do. Do you think it's difficult in that way?
Right, yeah. It certainly opens that up. Yeah, it can be, yes. Well, the thing I always always think about is acting, we're like ambassadors for empathy. And we live in, frankly, a very apathetic world. So the difficulty is, first of all, finding empathy within ourselves for other people. Also, like, it's like love, self-love. And then being able to articulate that for people to see and opening up in that cathartic manner, people's humanity. So that is difficult, and it becomes increasingly difficult as, you know, theatre is in some cases kind of, even in like what's happened over this period, kind of put to the side, the lives of actors put to the side in terms of their well-being, in terms of the support that they need. When we know, and has been known in pretty much all civilizations, that theatre and storytelling is so crucial to our well-being. And also, you know, if you want to put it in a kind of capitalist setup, it's so, so important for the economy. So yeah, I think acting is hard. I think the notion of how important acting is hard to articulate. And I think, as you say, as we walk out in that kind of being disenfranchised or disempowered in terms of how valuable we can be and we are and how much we serve our communities. And it's not even necessarily just on stage, right? It's not just when we're getting paid. It's actually just, I've heard countless kind of stories of, and I'm a part of being actors who can just listen. We're great listeners. And also that kind of parallel between actors and, not to say this is our profession, but counselling, right? So my partner, she's doing counselling at the moment. And she's doing person-centred theory by Carl Rogers. And it's kind of like almost 101 acting. 101 acting in terms of how an actor approaches character. You don't have judgment. You have positive regard for that person. Of course, we have an outside mind outside of that room. We're like, well, this person's not a very great person. But inside that room, when we are approaching this person, positive regard, constantly listening, allowing soundnesses, allowing that person to self-actualize, which is kind of go through, as it were, the play, say their lines and be as truthful with those lines as possible. And that's how we are to people as well. Or we can be. You know, there's a notion of acting being either persuasive or manipulative. You kind of want to fall into, you know, we're playing with truth and lies at the same time. It can be difficult, yes. It requires a lot of introspection. My first experience is going into drama school. Was a lot of, like, we did bedroom exercises. So we had to set up our bedrooms in the classroom, and we had to just just wake up in the morning, brush our teeth and go through the day with an audience. And that was incredibly difficult. We're so self-conscious. We're so our beings are so hinged on social, on the social construct that we exist in, on how we look to other people, or how we feel around other people, what other people do to us. We're so sensitive. So, you know, having to explore that all the time, or being conscious of that, and that becoming a profession, can be very difficult.
Has playing the characters you played changed who Jam is? You know, does it have an impact at that level? Does it become, do have you become someone different because of, say, the obvious example, you know, playing Hamilton for 2 going on 3 years?
Yeah, definitely. 100%. Because, well, it can deepen your level of empathy, which it certainly has for me. And yeah, so your level of understanding. And also, like, for me, it opens up the notion of stories and storytelling, right? Everyone has their own story. Everyone has the heroes and the villains of their story. But then every hero is a villain. Every villain is a hero. Like, and allowing that to be true of any person. I could look at some of the worst people. And then there's other elements that kind of play in that. But yeah, definitely. The first play I did out of Drama School Torn with Nathaniel Martello White, you know, I think, oh, I know this world, I know these people. But then obviously once you explore it, you realize, well, I know them to a point. But then there's so much more that I don't know. There's so much more exploring and discovering. And then in that, I'm meeting people in the rehearsal space, other actors, and also meeting them in a space where we can be vulnerable, where we can explore and express and open ourselves up in ways that we wouldn't otherwise on our day-to-day. So, yes, 100% I've changed. We're always changing, right? But then it comes into a whole other theory of, like, identity. Is it always the same, or does it change? It changes with our environment.
What would your friends who aren't actors say, do you think? Like, you must have friends, you know, that maybe from football coaching, or maybe from before that at school, who aren't actors. Do they think, I mean, do you get a lot of, like, oh man, you've, that's acting nonsense talking? Like, do you get a lot of dismissal from them about the person you become, or the path that you've gone on, or how do they view what it is you do and who it is you become?
Well, I don't think there's much change in how they perceive me, because I, you know, once you're in the circles that you're with, from whatever period of time, you always kind of return into that. There's always that kind of, I don't know if it's necessarily the social expectation, but it's just like the glove. The hand fits into the glove, and that's always how it has been with any of my, like, the friends that I return to from home. But then, of course, as that, if we're going with the analogy of hand fitting into a glove, like, it's seen, I've experienced other things, but so have they. Like, we've all experienced different things, and we come with different ideas and different thoughts. And certainly what changes, I've certainly noticed in myself, because one thing that acting certainly can do, but then also we're, like, in a world now where politics is kind of unavoidable, but I was certainly politicized in my acting, in the characters I explored, the hardships they may have experienced, or whatnot, the historical context, social context that these plays or pieces are in. And so I certainly return with those kind of conversations, and so do my friends, really. And so we just, yeah, constantly changing and bouncing off each other with ideas and thoughts. But I've certainly got the bug for, like, creating now. I didn't really have that bug beforehand. It was like, I just want to be in things. You know, I want to see what, you know, be a part of these great pieces, these great plays, new ones, old ones, however you want to look at it. But now I'm like, oh, hey, now I'm looking at the people I've been surrounded by most in my life, my family, friends. I'm like, actually, all the stories are here. All the, not necessarily like, hey, I'm going to take your story and I'm going to make a hell out of money out of it. More like, there are people whose voices need to be heard, who will connect to other voices who haven't had their voices heard themselves. And so, like, that's where I feel there's a responsibility there. I guess to my family and my community and my friends.
Okay, so talking about being politicized, we're nearly there. If I could make you president of the industry, or dictator, and you could change anything about the industry, what would be at the top of your list? What things would be at the top of your list about things about our industry that upset or annoy you or anger you?
I mean, I'm not exactly sure how this would change the thing, but I think it's how the direction of money shapes the direction of art. So some kind of like, you know, that notion of, would you be doing this if there was no money involved? It's like, if I was to change the arts, I'm trying to change the society in which whatever, you know, those arts exist, you know, if it's the Arts Council, or it's like, you know, in Britain, wherever it is, it's kind of like what impact, a negative impact money has on it. Of course, there's positives in terms of getting the funding, getting your grants to put on your piece. But then there's the negatives in terms of what pieces get shown, who has the money, who has the power. So it's about that power dynamic, which always, you know, you follow the money, you find out how that works. Follow the money and see where it goes. Oh, there you go.
See?
I've done it.
What do you think? What do you think things are going to look like for us coming out of this? Have you thought ahead to beyond your own show, but just the industry at large? What, how this might have changed things for us, or for society and society's relationship to art?
Well,
big question. Big fucking question.
God's sake. I'm not really the one to be asking these questions.
Yes, you are.
Yes, I am. I have something to say, and I'm going to say it. Well, when you look at things like this, the Globe having to put out a call of emergency saying this is not looking, you know, this could be the end. It's outrageous. But then, and so though, it's about taking responsibility on all sides in terms of, who, you know, where are the most essential aspects to our society? Who, you know, when you've still got, as it were, low paid work being considered low skilled or key workers, you know, it's that kind of direction of, that perception, that negative perception that really pervades our society. So in terms of what happens next and how things will go, I mean, you're seeing a lot of small businesses getting squashed, and you're getting a lot of money getting absorbed by these big corporations. And that's not necessarily in our sector, but then it is, right? Because they're those big West End shows, you know, some subsidized theatre, some, but not all. A lot of them are getting kind of drowned out as well by this. It makes you think, I don't know, I kind of, it's like a sponge, right? It's like a sponge sucking up all the kind of wealth, and like wealth is going to fall in the hands of the most wealthy, who are actually by, in the most part, getting richer. And that's across all kind of industries. So that's where my worry comes in, that the theatres that were kind of having like a, well, I don't know, we'll see, a renaissance of like regionals. I just think we're going to need a much more radical way of doing things after this point. I just won't be the way it was before, right? And there'll be excuses saying, oh, we can't do this or we can't do that. And it's kind of like, well, people are going to have to speak up and say, well, it's unacceptable. Because who's getting bailed out? They haven't spoken to, as it were, like, you know, your Virgin Airlines and all these people that have taken huge, huge subsidies off of the government and the taxpayer are getting bailed out. I don't know. My thoughts aren't as coherent as they need to be, because it is not my kind of, not the thing that I'm particularly well versed in. But just knowing the kind of notions of history and how things have usually panned out, there is always the element of the small guys coming last, and who gets considered the small guy, who gets considered the most expendable, and it's, the arts certainly comes into that. So, you know, I was told in the first year in drama school, you know, being an actor is a political point. To be on stage is political, and I think we have to really, you know, in times like this, which people are acknowledging, there's no better or more necessary time to speak up. And so it's going to be very, very, very difficult and tense after this.
It's potentially creatively revolutionary. You know, that's the thing is, it's negative. People lose their lives, as you said at the very outset of this. There's no way you can gloss this and turn it into a positive. It just can't happen.
Right.
But we can, after the fact, when the dust has settled, try to make the best of it, I think. And there is a potential, as with all huge social shifts and things like this, for it to be a positive force for creativity, if not for the money that follows that. Like, sure, there could be some great work comes out of that. Whether people make money is a whole other thing. But there will be great work that comes out of this, whether it gets seen and whether, you know, that's I guess the positive. But
absolutely, and yes, definitely. I mean, I think what really needs is a shift in government. and then it's placed back.
Needs a shift in Dominic Cummings' fucking chair is what it needs.
Cummings and
hopefully by the time this goes out later this week, Dominic Cummings will be but a distant memory.
He'll have decided to depart and spend the rest of his time on a castle.
He'll have developed a conscience. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, man. I could go. This is a whole other podcast, dude. A whole other fucking, the Dominic Cummings podcast.
It's a whole
Where's thing. Dominic this week?
It's fucking a whole, hell. Thing. He's not sure he's got bad eyesight.
Do you know what's brilliant is yesterday I realized he's Cassius. Yesterday at the press conference, he made sense to me for the first time. Like, why is this dude not prime minister? And then yesterday I went, it's because he's fucking useless. Like, uninspiring, but he is obviously, behind the scenes, he's very good at getting people to do things, to convince his Brutus, no, you need to step forward and do this. You're the guy, right? And yesterday I was like, oh shit, I never realised he was such an unimpressive dude as I did yesterday at the press conference. I went, that's why that guy can't do it alone. And it all of a sudden, just something clicked in yesterday. I was like, Cassius.
He can't make that swim, you know. He's trying to swim. I couldn't make it. And Caesar, he
can't. You know what I mean?
Boris carrying him across the long way. You should have.
You know what I mean?
You shouldn't have got in the pool in the first place.
Yeah, get out of the pool, dude.
Yeah.
Go dry yourself off.
Literally, dry yourself off and isolate.
So, last question, kind of. If you could go back to that guy who, let's say, is coming out of RADA and doesn't have an agent, and is about to embark on what turns out to be the longest unemployed period in his career to date, and hopefully forevermore. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give that guy?
Be yourself. Be yourself. And that's easier said than done. But being true to yourself, you know, to thine own self, be true. And celebrate that in yourself. Celebrate. You know, we've all got things to work on in our lives, all notions of like how we can love ourselves better, love each other better. And I don't say that with that kind of glittery fairy tale dust sprinkled all over it. It's a very particular type of practice that happens and has to be practiced throughout your life. But in those early days of being young, be true to yourself in whatever way that kind of manifests, and be honest with yourself. It's about an honesty, an internal honesty. That's what I'd say. So yeah, be true to yourself.
Be yourself's pretty good. I'll take that. It's actually it's fairly common. It's out of, I'd say, 40 interviews I've done, it's maybe come up 3 or 4 times, which is unusual because most things only come up once. It's usually so specific to the individual, like, you know, change your underpants more frequently or whatever, that it's never, but that has come up certainly more than a few times. Last question. Are you in anything at the minute?
No, not really. I mean, I'm waiting. We've had the blessing and the privilege of being within the Hamilton company that they're kind of holding us down until Hamilton reopens. So I'm doing Hamilton in Los Angeles. We're meant to open on the day of which lockdown happened. We were meant to open in LA. So we're just waiting for that. So that'd be 22 and between now and then. I don't know. You know, they're saying that maybe.
But that's great though, because you're all of a sudden free for filming, which you haven't been free for 2 years since you became Jamil Mosman.
Since I became who I really am. Didn't know until.
But you know what I mean? Things work in weird ways, man. Listen. Thank you very, very much for 1 hour and 13 minutes of your time, which is longer than I said it would take. It's been a pleasure chatting to you, man. I could listen to you a lot more, and I'm sure other people could as well.
Hey, man, just trying to find a way, man. Trying to find a way.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.